This is Geek Speak, episode 27 of season 16. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Hey, Miles.
How's it going?
Quite well, thank you. We also have Brian Young. He's an iOS developer, designer, and software conference producer. Hey.
Hey, how you doing, Lyle?
Pretty good. Brian, tell us about coding and learning to code.
Oh, we're going to jump right into that one. Okay.
I think we are.
So last week, you were talking to, I forgot the gentleman's name, of learning to code.
Oh, put me on the spot. Quincy.
Quincy, yes.
Larson.
And you're talking a lot about his program for learning to code, his community to learn to code. And, for the last couple of years, there's been a lot of talk about teaching kids to code and lots of different ways to do it. And Apple has entered the fray not only with their new language, Swift, which they released a couple years ago, but this year at their WWDC conference, they showed the beta to something called iOS Playgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not the playgrounds that developers use on the development environment.
In Xcode.
In Xcode with a Mac. This is a whole new app, but it is using the Swift language, and it does have some pretty amazing features, because you can sit there on an iPad now and program in a full compiled language that has access to a whole host of different libraries and frameworks that you can pull up things like 3D graphics and use the full library for playing with the audio or image manipulation or all the basics that the operating system has to offer.
Can you play with that now, even though iOS 10 is not coming out for a while? Is it available as an app?
If you signed up as a developer, you can have access to it. And I was trying to play with it today. Unfortunately, as a beta, they're always...
It's buggy.
It's buggy. They're changing things. And I think they released a new version today. So everything I downloaded into the app is breaking.
So this is kind of playing with the programming environment in native space on a tablet. So you're not able to launch an app from this place, but you can definitely try things out.
So let me back up a little bit, because How did you learn how to code?
I learned how to code by looking. I took a course, I think, in school, in college. But the way I really learned was in web development, you can actually view source in a browser. And someone showed me that, and I slowly learned to do HTML development in browser by just modifying stuff and resaving. And then that's kind of fell into editing some of these Perl scripts, and then I kind of taught myself. So it was all right. Self-taught, no formal, except for one Pascal class I think I almost failed in.
Pascal, wow.
Yeah.
This is a pretty common story these days, especially with JavaScript and web development.
Yeah.
So I started really similar way, only it was a generation before that. It was with HyperCard,
I remember HyperCard. I used to work on HyperCard stuff. Sure.
Oh yeah. It was kind of the precursor to the web in the sense that it had the idea of linking to things, but it had its own language in there. And what was great about it is it was really simple to open up and just play with it. So that's what is great about the web, and that's why there's so many people that know how to use JavaScript these days, because you can just open up a web browser and you can start changing what's there and seeing what happens. So this app, iOS Playgrounds, is sort of aiming for that same thing. You can open it up and just start playing. You've got all these example workbooks that are going to be available for it. And so you're typing on one side the commands, and on the other side you can see what happens. You just hit
now,
run.
You have young kids that don't know how to program, but they definitely put up with you to some degree when you talk about programming. Have you showed them this?
Oh, yeah. I sat them down with it.
And?
They were totally engaged right away, because it has a cute little character in a little floating island. It looks just like a game. They played with some other things like this. But this one, so there's other teaching kids to code sort of systems out there that use blocks, where you have a command that's in the form of a block, and you drag it out and you put it there, and you have ways to do loops and control structures by dragging those out.
When you say blocks, it looks kind of like Legos in some ways.
It looks very much like Legos.
Sure.
And you can build up a program that way.
And your kids have done that.
And my kids have done that.
Right.
So they saw this, and this is text-based, but it has a lot of those UI affordances that allow you to do similar things. Like when you're doing a repeat loop, there's a begin and the end, and the commands inside that get repeated over and over again. So you can actually take the repeat loop and drag a line of text, a line of code from one spot into that loop.
Got it.
So it's really similar.
Automatically, you can't do a loop without having the start and the end. It's like impossible to actually do that.
Right. So
of course, as we develop
there.
With text, when you're just typing, you can do that accidentally, yeah. and your app does not work.
But what's really amazing to me is, when I was playing with HyperCard as a kid, I was just blown away that I could actually make a button. I mm-hmm. could take this tool, this computer of mine, and make a button, and that button actually did something, and I could tell it what it could do.
Doesn't take a lot to amaze you, huh?
I think that was amazing at the
sure.
time, because the graphical UI was new, and apps just did what they did. You couldn't change them.
Right.
But here is a way to change an app. So what I'm excited about what this can do is you have all of the basic libraries that you need to do graphics and audio and all these other stuff, all the fundamental libraries of the operating system. So there's a huge world of possibilities out there that you can do, that you can hook into and make that were totally closed off on iOS
right.
without this.
Right.
And you're using exactly the same what we call APIs.
And,
that,
and
that
to be clear,
use.
Like the development system on a Macintosh is relatively free to download. You can do that from a Mac. You can build stuff for iOS and Play. You can actually deploy it without having an Apple developer license, and that costs like $100 or so a year. But what you're saying is this actually brings that coding and playing experience to an iOS device, so a tablet, or potentially an iPhone, but I'm assuming that right now it's for tablets.
No, it's just very hard to do it on a small screen.
This is the thing that's neat about this, and what I got excited about when I was talking with the people that founded code.org a couple years ago. We had him on, Patel something, I can't remember his name, was on the show to talk about the idea of getting a day of code across America in grammar schools and high schools, having people code. One of the things that they started doing is they got really cool intellectual property to be associated with this development. And pretty soon you were building Plants versus Animals. You were building a scene of Angry Birds. And so you're coding, but with characters that were engaging and fun, very much like a game with code. And that's what this thing does. When you say it's an interesting character, he's walking around a 3D environment, you don't have to animate the walk cycle of the character.
No, the commands are like walk forward,
yeah.
walk forward, turn left, walk forward. And then it will, this particular, I'm going to call it a workbook. I need to look up the actual term is.
Yeah.
It encourages it by, you go through the different stages. First, it's just teaching you how to put the commands down. Then it's teaching you how to group them in a function and how to write a function and then how to use that function. And it's totally open-ended. You don't have to do what it's telling you to do.
Right.
But it gives you a reward for completing the task.
A guidance of some sort. Yeah. Very cool.
It is really cool. But you're talking about Xcode. Anybody that's ever tried to like download a IDE, a development environment that has any sort of history to it, they're incredibly complex.
Yes.
They're actually a giant umbrella that cobbles together, in some cases, hundreds of tools in a way that's trying to make it easier. But underneath there's all these commands to command line tools, all these flags, all these settings, and all this history that you have to be able to manage what all those settings do.
Uh-huh.
And Apple doesn't modularize it at all, so every update is another 2.5 gigabytes.
2.5? It's
or,
up to 5.
Oh, 5. Okay, sorry. My mistake.
So so it's really intimidating, and it's really powerful for professional developers that do this every day. But what Apple's obviously doing here is they're taking the opportunity of not only do they have their new language, but they are making an environment that is fully functional, but only trimmed down to those things you absolutely need for mm-hmm. That task.
So for like playing, for getting to learn it.
Yeah. So yeah. As professional developers, we're used to typing and having autocomplete tell us what the possible mm-hmm. or likely commands are that we're working with. And they have on their keyboard the same kind of thing. It gives you suggestions of what you might be trying to do. And
yeah.
it's pretty magical on what the choices are.
When I was teaching artists how to program, or introduction to programming for artists at UCSC in the grads program, what continually happened was I'd say, okay, we're going to start to learn to program JavaScript. But actually, what we're going to do for the first 3 hours is get your computer ready for you to learn how to start to run JavaScript. Because we have to get a text editor in your machine. You have to understand what a text editor is. And if we want to put it on a web server for it to work for the rest of the world, we have to get an FTP client. And if you're an FTP client, you probably need to know how to change permissions. So we may want to have you be able to have SSH access. Pretty soon, I'm teaching all this stuff that has nothing to do with coding. And so the later strategies were, let's just pull up an IDE in web browser that's already there, and you can start coding there. But of course, then the people aren't saving that content. It's not local to them. They don't own it as much.
Miles, I like to think of it in terms of you're trying to teach someone how to be literate, and you're starting off with the letters. Well, what can you say with the letters? Well, each letter has a name, and they come in a certain order according to the alphabet, and you map them to keys on a keyboard. Wait, what does that have to do with actually learning the language of English?
Right. Nothing.
Nothing. But you need to have that base in order to move forward.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this isn't for just for kids either. If you have any inkling of trying to figure out what all this coding stuff is about and you've never sat down, this is a great environment
to sit down
in. But,
of course, you're teasing people because you can't get this yet.
Oh, right. I'm sorry.
It's like so
sorry,
mean.
You know, I live in a time warp of about 6 months ahead
yes,
of what
I
the
know.
Public has. So
that happens
actually,
for us.
But in the fall, it should be available.
Will you remind us all in the fall
yes,
to play with it on an iPad
I will.
Device?
I will. Right. And hopefully at that point, there will be people who have made essentially how to code books, workbooks out
with
of
us.
That will be available for
so
this.
Can you develop a how to code workbook for your own?
Yeah. So that's where the comparison to HyperCard really comes back to it. You can make your own and share them. And
they're like little magazines, like little books kind of.
They are. They're interactive books. So some parts of it are just explaining a concept in text or pictures. And then you get to code to the example, and it'll have hints to tell you whether you're going the right way.
Oh, that's cool. I think you should write one. I think that's awesome.
I've got it. Yeah. And there's already people doing this for Xcode playgrounds, and I'm sure they'll adapt them. But we've got a good write-up that will be a part of this show synopsis that has an educator's point of view on using this for learning how to code or teach it to kids in awesome. Schools. It's pretty good.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, I think since we've got Miles on the show, thank you, Brian, we might as well go ahead and do some politics. What is the FBI talking about?
Well, the FBI is talking about not indicting Hillary Clinton for that email, her own personal email server being used for while she was at the job in the State Department.
So what's the rationale?
Well, they did say that it was not a good thing to do, and if it were just some random minion in the State Department, they probably would indict. But at her level, because the Secretary of State is also one of the people who decides what is classified and what is not, there is some part of the decision-making process there that was a chip in her favor. I agree with the result, and at the same time, I personally don't think she should have had a personal email server. I'm glad that
Well, first of all, she's totally fine for having a personal email server. That's completely valid. It's not okay to use to have governmental communication on your personal email server. Like, she could have had her own personal email. Who cares?
Yes.
I mean, it was the why? I'm
the,
surprised.
The issue is she was actually using it for personal use. For government usage. Yeah. She wasn't using. She didn't ever convey. Classified information. That was the distinction.
Uh-huh.
So she was using it as a personal email server to do State Department business.
See, I don't think that's okay. Because I think that in some sense you've got to, if you're doing State Department business, you want to use the systems in place that have security.
See, there's
it, right?
the thing though. If it's your friend, but then they're also doing something that's, they're a defense contractor, or if there's so much overlap and there's such a wiggly line there, it's hard to make that clear separation. And
really?
Yeah. I mean, think about how your day-to-day life is, like when you thought – how you thought the corporate world was, for example, when you were 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get into the corporate world and you're like, oh, that's why they do that.
Yeah, but I'm arguing that, like, I have a personal email address for Netflix, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I do my Netflix business there. And if somebody sends an email to me that's personal there, I tell them, please don't send to this email address, and vice versa. Like, I segregate my email because one is for personal business and one is for work business. I mean, I don't see – and I think it's totally fine that I run my own mail server for my personal business because it's my own choice.
Right. Like, well, there's this back and forth of for – Clinton's part, I see her point of view in that she wanted to do certain things. She was used to certain communication styles that were not made available to her due to the security restrictions.
Right, like at the end of every email having some disclaimer being added on by somebody else. That kind
I don't
of
know about that, but I mean, yeah.
Things of that nature that are like outside of control if you don't control your own server.
Well, yeah, if you're talking to someone, you have to get routed through a certain set of things and have them checked over, and that would slow things down. And,
so you agree, though, they shouldn't indict her for this?
I believe that the letter of the law, as it goes, she should not be indicted for it. I am thankful that after this came up, they have changed those laws to say that you cannot do it anymore. Let's put it that way. Because I do believe that if you are doing something that even tangentially has to do with a government job, that you should have that in the public record, which means having it on a public server and subject to the security restrictions of that. Because the security on – frankly, the security on their server was not up to snuff. On the flip side for her, government technology moves very slowly.
Sure.
And part of it is because they want to get the security right. Unfortunately, a lot of the federal government doesn't have security right. But at that level, you know, within the executive branch, within, you know, cabinet level officers, yes, the security is quite tight. Among mm-hmm. people who have to deal with classified material, it is very tight. They have those procedures in order for a reason.
Right. Okay, cool. So you agree with it? Okay, makes sense. I'm totally on board with it. I'm a little surprised that your feeling of like looseness is there. It seems like a pretty clear cut case of it. She was doing it wrong. I mean,
I'm glad that the rules have changed. Uh-huh. I don't think she should have been indicted because,
yeah,
the rules did not say that specifically. But yeah, you know, so that's why I think she shouldn't be indicted. But yes, I do think that it should be made not available anymore.
All right.
Well, we haven't even gotten into the whole fact that why are we communicating government stuff over email?
Oh, in general.
Yeah. Email is a horrible medium for anything that has any level of security or privacy to it.
Well, there's where a lot of the restrictions come into play because you also have to have what is the security of the endpoint that you're talking to,
right,
and what filters get – because different messages get sent through different filters, and you have to make sure that you are marking things a certain way so that they get passed through the filter correctly. And yeah, that can be onerous sometimes. And not to mention the fact that, who knows, maybe the mail servers ended up being slow and she wanted a personal mail server so that her personal access to be able to get out and talk to people was faster. Maybe she wanted the support from from Microsoft Exchange to be able to retract messages. I mean, because there are features like that where you're like, oh, I didn't mean to send that. Let me pull that back out again.
Yeah.
Before the person has read it, then you don't get it.
Right. And then, of course, I'm assuming also that if you do have top secret documents, you're actually not sending those through email. You're sending some kind of reference to the document that you then have to authenticate and log into.
Well, here's hoping. Yeah, but yeah. From what I understand, there would be top secret emails going through, but you wouldn't want to have it through the private through a server that's not managed by a vetted security team.
Yeah.
For the government, which she wasn't.
All right. Cool, Miles. So, Brian, I'm not sure which story you want to cover next. Go ahead and tell me.
We're having like a comment battle here in the doc as we talked about.
Yeah. So, what do you want to chat about?
So, I noticed you had something new in your house.
Oh, yes, I did.
For a Father's Day gift, was that
my Father's Day gift was an Echo, and the Echo, of course, is Amazon's personal digital home audio assistant, and you can talk to it and ask it questions, and it will respond. It's actually highly effective. I heard a lot of good things about it.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of good things about it too. This is the first time I got to play with one.
I know this is effectively live, but at the same time, I half expected you to say, and this is the Amazon Echo. This is the Amazon Echo.
It's really funny. You can cause it to echo. You can tell it to do Simon Says. This is the favorite thing of my children, because you actually can say...
Oh, that must drive you nuts.
You can say Alexi, and it's actually not Alexi. It ends with an A. But if I say it, and people are broadcasting it, it might respond. So Alexi, but actually with an A. You can say that, and then you can say Simon Says and some phrase, and whatever you say, it'll try to repeat that. It doesn't do intonation. You can't say, shut up. It'll just say, shut up. You know, it's like kind of robotic. The kids love to tell it to shut up, obviously. That's a fun thing for them because they're not being rude. It's a machine. It's not actually being rude. We don't exactly enjoy that, but they do.
We've had shows where we talked about that, the ethics of talking down to a computer.
Yeah, and I'm fine with them treating it as an inanimate object. But it is hard because you're using a communication style that is normally reserved to humans, and your approach to doing that, it's very common for someone to say thank you. Like, you ask for something, and then it does it, and then you say thanks, and you know you're being stupid because it's not listening to the thank you. It doesn't matter.
But at the same time, you start giving all these commands, and you just start telling it what to do, and you start to feel like you're just being a bit of a jerk there. Yeah. You're just ordering things around.
Yeah, I mean, so the calendar feature is pretty cool. You can say, you know, what's going on today, and it will kind of read out your calendar, and there's profile for myself and for my wife, Maggie, so we can switch profiles and do that. And I do, you know, ask it for calendar information to find out what's going on, which is kind of cool. Setting timers is way easy, and you don't have to wait for it. Like Siri, you've got to hold down something, and then you wait for it to beep, and then you say something. And there's like a little bit of engagement that I've never gotten successfully with Siri. With this Echo thing, it's quite easy to get it to respond to a natural language, you know.
Well, that's also the case with Android phones, or at least many of them, that do OK Google. That's
yeah. The key phrase.
Sorry for anyone who has that going. I totally forgot to censor myself there.
And I said the Echo thing too as well. It is tricky to talk about this without inferring pain to people.
Yeah. So,
although my devices have never been triggered from a podcast I was listening to in the car. But I don't know if it filters out whatever is broadcasting to the speakers.
Well, so the first thing you did to me, Brian, is you tried to order something I never order. Something like
it was toilet paper.
Toilet paper.
You never order that?
Well, I don't order toilet paper on Amazon. No, I don't think so. I think I go to my local store. But and I don't think it was toilet paper. It was like soap or something.
No, it was Cascade later.
Cascade, yeah. And so you said to order it, and it read out this information and said, this is what we recommend. You want to order it. And everybody in the room goes, no! Because, of course, you are concerned about making a purchase just by voice. But I'm sure I'll do it at some point soon.
Well, so I'm kind of fascinated about this because, of course, Amazon wants you to buy things through the Echo. That's obviously one of the things that they made it for. But it's a totally different UI. It's a voice UI. You're sitting there talking to something, and it somewhat robotically recites back your different options. And if this was a real person, you'd be able to, like, yeah, I give them a hint to speed it up or stop. And it, as a device, it doesn't do that. It's going
to
be
to some degree. If it starts reading something out, you can tell it to stop. Anytime you want, you can tell it to stop.
Okay.
It's kind of like that. I don't know if you can, like, next through or fast forward or any of that kind of stuff to what it's saying. But if you are always buying something, they have one-click buttons for purchasing stuff in the home, right? So if I was always buying Cascade, I could tell it, hey, you know, buy Cascade. And then it would start reading. I go, stop. Yes, buy that. Like, I'm sure that would work. Maybe it wouldn't work. But the input is a little clunky, I agree.
So I've got an article here from TechPinions that they did a whole pretty decent survey on how these voice assistants are used. OK Google, Siri, and Amazon Echo. And they definitely group the Echo apart from OK Google and Siri because there's a few things that set it apart. First of all, it's a device that is apart from you. It's a standalone device. And
it's not a personal thing.
It's not a personal device. It's a home device. And they've got a survey of where people have decided to put these. What do you think is the top place they've decided to put the Echo in the
kitchen?
Home? Yes, absolutely. 50% of the people put it there. And then after that, living room, family room. And I don't know why anybody of these 15% would you put it in their bedroom, but they do. But it makes sense in the kitchen to me because that's the place where you got your hands messy. You can't just go and touch a touchscreen easily.
And the other thing is that, like, for us, we have an audio system in the living room that actually feeds speakers outside and in the living room and in the kitchen. But that's for playing music background, right? And so this device, most of the time that we're actually hanging out together as a family or being in a space, it's in the kitchen, and there isn't already a built-in audio system there. Though the speakers are there, that the control unit isn't. So it made sense from that perspective. I'm assuming that's relatively common for people to have, like, the media room of their home has all the media playing capabilities. So putting it in there is kind of redundant. Put it in the kitchen, maybe it doesn't have a sound system. This thing, by the way, the Echo, the large one I've got, is a really good sound system. It sounds good.
For a little speaker, yeah. It's
pretty good. It's impressive. Let's go on with the story.
Well, sure. And they were trying to figure out what people use these for most. And you want to take your best guess?
Timers?
Yep. Top one is timer.
I'm just going with how we use it. And then asking conversion units.
Ooh, now you guys must do more serious baking?
No, I mostly play with that aspect. I just like the idea of being able to do that. Math questions, spelling. It's kind of cool. You can just say, you know, how do you spell onomatopoeia? And it will spell it for you, which is kind of cool.
So,
Shut up, Miles. Miles just totally looked at me like I was, so that's why you got it. What was that?
Yeah. I was actually thinking, you need it for onomatopoeia? There are a lot of other simpler words that you can't spell.
Ouch, ouch. Let's move on. Okay, so number two on there is to play a song. We already talked about.
Oh, yeah, of course, right, with the music.
And this is one I hadn't thought of, but reading the news off of the Echo. You want to go and sit down and get breakfast while it's reading the
news
to you?
Yes, you can kind of give me an update, and it will give you a list of things. You can choose what goes in there, and it is kind of nice. At the same time, in the morning, I normally don't listen to news in the house. I'm on the road when I listen to news, right? I get in my car to drive 15 minutes before a shuttle. That's when I engage with my news content. So having it in the house, it was a little distracting. We're moving around too much, you know, dealing with three kids and stuff. But yeah, I can definitely see that as a good win.
Yeah. So one thing this the study pointed out, which is it's not actually a clearly defined thing. It's the author's best guess, but a lot of people have noticed that the Amazon Echo seems to be more accurate in the commands that it accepts.
I'm almost haven't had a miss.
Yeah, yeah.
Some kids last night had some, you know, it was a few kids, they're all kind of screaming and maybe there were some failures there. But for the adults in the room, I don't think we've ever had a situation where it didn't do what we were expecting. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, it says play a song, and instead it plays you sample the song because you don't have access to the song, and then it says you want to buy it.
Yeah. Having played with automated transcriptions for GeekSpeak and seeing the hilarious and useless results that are applied for me because I am not a voice transcription expert, the smaller the word set, the mm-hmm. smaller the vocabulary set, the better the accuracy is going to be. So right. if you have a system that's going to accept just about everything, like your Siri's, like your Google's, like your
Amazon seems to handle a lot of things.
Yeah, we were talking a few weeks ago. It's basically a command line for voice. So
I don't think of Siri and Echo as very different.
No?
The interfaces. No, I mean they're in purposes and intention. Give me directions from here to here. I can do that on Echo. I can do that on Siri.
Okay.
I've had more success on Echo than Siri. So this
author attributes to its higher accuracy to the simple fact that it's a plugged-in device.
Yep.
At the home.
It uses the power it needs to use.
Well, it uses the power it needs to use. It has a really good array of microphones. But on top of that, the internet is much more consistent than where most other people use Siri or OK Google, which is driving around.
And the audio environment doesn't change. So it's picking up a space, and it always is picking that same space up, right? So as it gets attuned to that space, you're talking in that space, it works. You know, with my phone, I'm sometimes in my pocket, sometimes it's out, sometimes I'm using a mic, sometimes, you know, I'm a wired mic, sometimes I'm not. And so there's a lot more side effects of what it actually is listening to.
Yeah.
Yeah. What else do they attribute to?
Well, no, that's
just
the main one. They believe that just the hardware and solid bandwidth is enough, because almost all of the voice recognition is happening on servers.
Yeah.
So it's just sending an audio stream up to the servers to analyze.
The one thing that's also going on with the Echo is that it is constantly recording and listening, which consumes a battery quickly. And it's looking for that key phrase, but it's recording all audio all the time. And then when it gets the key phrase, it then takes the rest of that phrase and sends it up to the cloud, if you will. So it's not like it's sending the entire room. But when you set up Siri or Google now to do that, it's doing a similar thing, but it's going to drain your battery a little bit faster, unless they're being really delicate on the usage. So they won't have to do that with plugged in. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So just to round this out, what people are using Siri and OKG for is almost 20%. The largest thing is to search the internet. I'm misrepresenting it. That's 40% of the use
of Google now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. is searching the internet. What was interesting is that Google announced that 20% of all Google searches now are through voice assistants.
Wow.
So
that kind of makes sense, I guess.
Well, it's starting to hit the point where people are really using these.
The other thing that's interesting about the Google in product is that when you're on the phone and you push that thing or you say it, what happens is not that it reads to you. It then displays your response. So it's very similar. On Siri the other day, I did something and it read back to me, "You want to call this person?" I was like in an elevator environment. I could whisper, you know, "Call this person." And then it's like, "You want to call this person?" And I'm like, "Yeah, thank you. That's what I want to do." But it had to be loud and engaging. And with G Now, it doesn't have to be loud and engaging. You can actually get just the search results back from a Google search, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, a little bit more immediate. This got me thinking, especially when we were talking about HyperCard a while ago. when I was a kid, I played with this stuff constantly, even though it wasn't quite as useful as some other ways of doing it. And that's how I got so good at the computer use that I did.
You played, you experimented.
I played and experimented, even when it wasn't up to par. So I've decided I've got to start doing that with these voice assistants, because they're obviously going to become more important.
Yeah.
Anyways, so I started trying to find some things to do with my chosen device, which is an iPhone, with Siri. And there's a couple things that were kind of cool to find out. Did you know you can use Siri to find out what plane is flying overhead of you?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. You can ask that question.
I knew about the app.
The app?
There's an app that does the same
thing. It's using the same API, I'm sure. And something else is Siri becomes a lot more useful when it understands relationships. When you put who's your spouse or who's your parents into your contact book.
Sure.
But you can do that right through Siri. You can say, hey, Siri, Lyle is my friend. And it'll go, who's Lyle?
So you can teach it that?
Yeah, you can teach that just directly through Siri.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So if you're driving around and... Actually, no, don't do this if you're driving around. If you're sitting at a stoplight... No, you can't do that.
No, just do it at home.
If you're sitting in a quiet...
Coffee shop.
And nobody's listening, you can start teaching it all the different relationships you have, and it'll start to be more useful.
So does that mean that if I say, hey, Brian's my friend, that it'll say, who's Brian? And then I'd say Brian Young, and of course, in my phone book is you, and so it would look you up. And then next time I said, hey, call Brian, it would automatically call you rather than Brian Young? It would have to ask. So I'm kind of setting up my local circle, if you will, of people I want to talk to.
Exactly.
I will set that up with Siri. I'll add Miles to it either. As well. Miles, do you use these voice command stuff at all?
Very, very rarely.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Probably more than anything else, force of habit.
Mm-hmm.
Just bringing up my phone, typing in, you know, opening the browser, typing in what I want is just...
Yeah, exactly. It's not as useful.
It's reasonably convenient for me just because it's how I've always done it. So spending the time to hold the button down, then say the thing, and then select the option that it puts forward as the option I want, it doesn't really buy me anything, and it's louder.
Right. Okay, so what other hacks do you have for Siri? Get any more?
I'll leave you with one more. If you ever find somebody else's iPhone, and I don't know if everybody knows how to find out who the owner of that iPhone is by tapping around,
you can just
hold the button and say, Siri, who owns this iPhone?
Awesome, that's great.
And it'll give you all the information you need to get it back to them.
So including phone number and stuff?
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Siri, who owns this iPhone?
I believe this iPhone belongs to Lyle.
Awesome, and yeah, displayed all my information. Cool.
Never mind how that's going to read off.
I was worried about that. I was ready to... His home phone number is, and address. Times when he's home, times when he's at work. All right, cool. Thank you very much for that. And of course, more commands from Siri and other things that we talk about. In fact, everything we talk about is up at the episode page for today's show. Today's show will be the 6th of July, 2016, episode 27 of season 16. In just a second, Miles, you can tell us about Comcast and about the company I work for. This will be fun. As most of you know, we went independent. Geeksby went independent. We now have, I think, 14 different people that have decided. Is that right? Maybe it's 13. 15 patrons so far. People have gone to Patreon and decided to give us a little bit of money every month. It's wonderful. It's allowing us to have some freedom and decisions to make the show better, and we really do appreciate it. So if you're interested, just go to geekspeak.org. Check out the links from today's show, and you can go click on support. And I want to thank people at the end of the show. All right, let's move on. So this is one of those stories where I might be able to say stuff and I might not be able to say stuff because I know some stuff about what's happening internally at Netflix. So go for it, Miles. Tell us what's going on, and maybe I'll be quiet.
X1 platform. That's what Comcast calls its popular video streaming service that gives it a little extra trying to remember what the specifics word for it. It doesn't count against your cap.
Yeah.
And so you can watch it at will. It sets a fixed quality rate, doesn't it? Or a bandwidth rate, anyway.
Yeah, effectively what's been happening is different companies have been offering this kind of free video service. They do YouTube and Netflix and other video services. And then basically when you use that service, they inject a slowdown, if you will, so that you get a decreased quality. But on a phone, which is normally used, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter that much. You don't notice it necessarily. And then they basically say, this is free bandwidth for you. You can use as much as you want, which is kind of nice from the ISP to do that and kind of nice. But at the same time, it's not exactly what's the free internet kind of concept where everybody
net neutrality?
It's not net neutrality. Based.
It's not net neutral.
Net neutral. Thank you very much. Go on.
So there's the issue, because Netflix and Comcast have had a fairly contentious history. There's been a lot of, hey, we already paid for our bandwidth. No, we want you to pay us twice. No, let's back and forth. And so this is nice because, I mean, let's be honest, Netflix is a huge percentage of the internet traffic that goes around these days, especially in terms of domestic prime time traffic. And it's a constant feed as opposed to web pages, which are relatively small, or YouTube, which is, you know, ad hoc looking at videos. Netflix, you turn it on and you leave it on for the entire season. So, but the fact that they've made this deal with Comcast is a little worrying for me, because this ends up being we're not fighting for net neutrality anymore. Netflix has now become large enough to bargain with the big boys, and now some new upstart wants to get into the game. Oh, sorry, you're not big enough yet, and you don't get to have that same leverage to be able to get onto that X1 platform and have that privileged position. So it's nice for people who don't want to or who are in danger of, you know, hitting their cap, which means they're watching way too much TV. But
I don't understand. Does Comcast have a home data cap?
Yeah. The residential service for – yeah.
Okay.
And well, so, it's something like 250 gigabytes a month, something.
Okay. So this has been known for a long time, and they have also said that unless things have changed, they have also said they're not enforcing that cap. And they –
selectively enforcing it depending upon the region and...
Yes, regularly they say they're doing a test in some region to see whether they should be turning or changing that policy to enforce it. So it's confusing that way. But yeah, so I guess that's the way that they're going to be able to enforce the cap is by having these holes through their cap.
You know, Miles, I'm looking at the story that you've got that's at Recode that covers this. And I know that I'm highly close to this kind of story
sure.
because of my daily business and everything. But some of the stuff that doesn't make any sense to me in this article is they're talking about how it says, let's see, it would also help Comcast have a more competitive video offering to others like Roku, Verizon, and Dish. Is Roku a video service? Roku doesn't offer network. So they're conflating providers like Verizon and Dish with Roku. It's like they don't even know they're talking about.
Well,
unless I'm mistaken, and Roku recently bought some network.
No, Roku is a strange player because they bundle like that Roku stick along with a bunch of different models of TV for their mm-hmm. smart TVs.
Sure.
And so then you get these bundling deals for to use the Roku HBO app is different from using, you know, some other things. Chromecast app.
Yeah,
so they do have specific deals with, for example, Xfinity with Comcast for which things can go through their hardware.
Roku has deals with Netflix, with Comcast?
Yeah.
Okay, so that does make sense. But they're, yeah, I don't know. It just seems like they're conflating. I don't think of Roku in any way as a network provider. Verizon, Dish Network, Comcast are all network providers, which also have television services attached.
Right.
And so I guess that's part of it.
But Roku is a platform. And so that's where it gets into. They're not necessarily a producer, but they are a platform where a lot of producers glom onto, and that's who they partner with.
We should walk across the street and ask them because they're actually across the street from here. We're going to find out. All right, interesting. So your concern is that this, as for a while, Netflix has been a proponent of net neutrality. In fact, we were a big supporter of net neutrality from a governmental perspective and recommendations.
Well, from a very good reason, because Comcast was being jerks for a long period of time as well to a lot of people and still are.
Yeah. So, but you're saying that now that this deal exists, all of a sudden, well, they're in bed together and therefore the little company doesn't have the same kind of affordance. And are you concerned that Netflix is going to stop pushing for net neutrality because we got what we wanted or something? Is that your thought?
It does make me worry that Netflix wouldn't be quite as big an advocate for net neutrality because they don't have anything at stake for their own bottom line.
Okay. And I would say that globally that's not the case. Like from a global perspective, Comcast is not giant. right?
Sure. So but then again, multinational corporations have different legal arms and different policies for different countries. That doesn't change. So net neutrality in one country, net neutrality in another doesn't really affect the business dealings that much for a multinational in so much as like speaking for things like Google, it's like Google Maps shows different things from one country to another depending upon, you know, the legal climate there. Some things are more secret than others, and then you have to worry about like what do you show between what do you show in Pakistan versus what do you show in India with regard to the Kashmir reason? Well, you show completely different maps is what you do.
All right, cool. Thanks for the story. It was great. And yeah, well, let's move on. So one of the things I want to talk about had to do with what Facebook promotes and what they don't promote. And recently, I think last week, there was a discussion from Facebook about it being clear that the consumer of the Facebook service mostly wants to see the feeds from people that they know or interesting things, and not necessarily the news, the political landscape news. And in fact, you see kind of a, and I kind of want to say, isolating themselves to their own little pocket of interests rather than going and being engaged in the world at a larger form.
Well, so what do people think of when they think of going to Facebook? What are they going to use it for?
Right.
So I know my own personal life. I only went there for family and friends that I wanted to see what was going on. And I'm actually using it less and less now because there's just a lot of stuff on there that I realized I wasn't interested in. I wasn't seeing as much about. I wasn't trying to control it like I used to see the family and friends I wanted to see. So the things I were seeing just wasn't interesting to me. So
once you see one kid's dance recital, you mean, what's the point?
As long as it's not your kid.
I still post those things. So, yeah, absolutely. What was it a year ago that they announced instant articles, and then Apple and Google also had their own similar initiatives? I think it was a year ago. So now they're turning around and saying, oh, well, that wasn't really successful?
Well, paper wasn't, but well, the instant stuff still is.
No, I think the instant stuff is useful, but what was happening was Facebook with Instant was saying, hey, whole bunch of publishers out there, come on our platform and we'll give you our eyeballs and you'll make a relationship with us and we'll cut the revenue and all that stuff. And when it comes down to what they're saying now is that actually people don't really want as much news as we thought, and so we're going to focus more on what they want.
So they made a big sell to the news publishers saying, this is the platform for you. You're going to be able to get eyeballs and more money out of it. And that was the thing that they were selling to...
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It would be faster, and therefore you'd get your stuff automatically. The whole instant was loading all the news stories early on, and so it would be no delay.
So right? Now they're saying, our people don't want that.
Right. So they're basically just changing their focus from news back to friends and family kind of circles, if you will. The downside of this is that it's putting people in bubbles. That's the part I don't like about it. Now, Miles, you mentioned Paper, which is an app that I've been using. Brian, you've been using too,
right?
Oh,
yeah. I've used it ever since it came out.
Yeah. So Facebook made this kind of alternate version of an iOS app that was your Facebook feed, but it was done in such a way that was a little more, I don't know, cutting edge or something.
Well,
it was pretty.
More swoopy.
More swoopy.
So yeah. Early on in the iPad, there was a particular designer I followed that came out with some really interesting apps that were related to reading news, reading things. And Facebook hired them and said, hey, we want you to make that really engaging experience where it feels like you're flipping papers and it's beautiful and it's well designed. No matter what the content is, it just is presented in a way that feels well designed. And that's the mission they gave to that team, and that's where Paper comes out of. And I only ever used it for the Facebook news. I should say my friends and family news, but you could also get news articles through that. It was designed that your personal feed is just right alongside all the news of the world or other news that you may have said that you'd like to see through this. And it was really beautiful. It flipped nicely.
It was really nice. The biggest thing about it that I liked was that it wasn't being integrated on all the time. Because it has such a low install base, doing things to change it to make it more functional for the mission of the company was just not paramount.
No
and
ads.
So it just sat there. There wasn't any ads. The instant stuff wasn't in there. But additionally, they didn't pull Messenger out as a separate app. You could actually do messaging inside the app. So from a large perspective, it was less hands-on from the company. It was kind of just a backdoor kind of way of doing it. That's what I liked about it. I used it pretty directly. I pulled off the normal Facebook app for months and months and months. And finally, I think reinstalled Facebook when Ben started working at Facebook. I was like, I better engage in this platform again. But you know, I just want to say that the reason why this is kind of important is that we're talking about 1.6 billion users every month are on Facebook. So if Facebook has more news there, the world is more aware of what's happening. If it has less news, the world is less aware. I mean, that's just the side effect of such a large eyeball potential, right? I mean, it's
well,
going to affect how people
that
work.
Assumes it's a zero-sum game. That assumes that that's the only news source for people.
No,
right? And that's not always the case.
I don't think that's true in this case. Lyle's just saying if there's more of a chance to see news, more people will see news. Now, if Facebook's usage goes significantly down, then that is the counteracting force. And that's what Facebook does not want.
Sure.
And now, so the thing that's kind of interesting about this is that it looked like this relationship that Facebook was kind of allowing publishers to inject into an already installed place and put their news stories there and kind of get people viewing and such had this potential of kind of saving the industry, right? Because if you had a really clear defined new income source, even if you didn't have to, you know, buy a subscription to Times, New York Times or something, you could actually get a story in there and the ad revenue was sharing and you weren't even aware of it, but your eyeballs were actually giving the New York Times or whatever money, that was kind of a win for the Times, right? So all these publishers were like, oh, this could save us. That's not Facebook's mission. That was never Facebook's mission to do this. At the same time, doing this kind of consumption was tricky. I mean, if it was planned, it was devious. In the sense that all those publishers kind of invested a whole bunch of time and got their revenue from this source, and now that source is going to slightly dry up. Not that anything changes, it's just going to get less people coming to your site. And so for small publishers where most of the viewing was through that, it really affects them. And that's the kind of sad thing about it, I guess.
Well, that's the story of news over the last 20 years, is how do you make a business model out of it?
Yeah, definitely. Well, anyway, so that Facebook is turning off paper. It's dead. It's going away. They're going to stop developing it. I'm assuming they're going to turn it off.
It's no longer in the App Store. And by the end of July, it just will not work. It won't be able to talk to the servers and have to remove it. Just a little bit of history. If there's any people that have been using the Mac for a long time out there, there's an app called the Delicious Library. This was known for being beautiful, 3D rendered, really high quality photorealistic kind of UI, which kind of started an entire UI movement on the Mac to make things looking hyper real. And that's where the designer for this paper app comes from, is out of that whole movement. Just a little tidbit.
I didn't know that's where it came from.
Yeah, his name is Meg Mattis.
Oh, that's cool. Okay, thanks for the paper story, the sad kind of paper story. Does Facebook allow an open API to access their data? It doesn't, right? It's closed. You can't. That's why there's not a whole bunch of apps like Twitter.
Right, exactly. Yeah. There's got to be that way. Does Google Plus?
Doesn't matter. No one uses it.
Yeah.
You can build apps in Google Plus because you can get access to stuff. I mean, that's one of the part of the API.
Well, Facebook does have what, 11,000 bots on it?
Right. You can make a Facebook app that interfaces with the system, but you can't make a client that people read their news stories through. Like, you can't. Could you? I mean, you see backward engineering.
There, I just did download an iOS app that does Facebook because it also did some other service at the same time, but I haven't played with it yet. So I don't
know. We've got to find an alternative just to see if there's something that's, you know, compelling to stay out of the design infrastructure, if you will, for Facebook. Okay. Jupiter. Talk to us about space, would you, Miles?
Yeah, sure. In validation of science and the fact that.
In validation of science or invalidation of science? Where was the space? Was that invalidation?
In space.
Thank you.
Validation of science.
All right, good. That's why you're smiling.
Didn't we have a discussion like this before the show?
And also of Einstein's theories of relativity, and in terms of astrometrics and all those things. NASA has launched the Juno space probe into Jupiter orbit, and you may have heard about that. But did you know that Jupiter is currently about 1.7 billion miles away, or rather the path that the spacecraft took to get there? Because not all nearest paths are straight lines. The closest distance between two points is not a straight line when you're talking about orbital dynamics.
Sure.
You're using the word closest. You mean the quickest, right?
Closest.
In space-time, closest.
Oh, okay.
As odd as that sounds.
And quickest. They got to Jupiter orbit within... And remember, the starting point was 1.7 billion miles. That's the total distance for their track. They got within tens of miles of their target.
Wait, with no adjusting thrusters or anything like that?
Well, if they had some adjustments, they were minor maneuvering thrusters probably earlier on in the thing. But the more fuel you put onto a ship, the heavier it gets, which means you need more fuel to get it up in the air. So in general, you don't want to have the flu. You want to get that.
You want to get your math right first.
Yeah. You want to get it up in the air, and then you fire off your rocket to say, we're going in that direction. We want to go that fast. Let's do a minor correction. Okay. Hope everything goes okay. hope in a couple of years when that ends up in some.
Yeah. How long has it been flying? How long has it been traveling? Do you know?
It's been a few years. I'm trying to remember what year it actually was launched. Unfortunately,
next
I don't remember.
Next time you're in an environment where you're rolling, like. Bicycles are too hard to not steer, but like roller skates at like an ice rink, try to position yourself to aim somewhere and then push forward and just try not to change anything and see where you actually end up. You deviate more than you'd think you deviate because of the cars are like this too, right? You take your car and put it on a straightaway and then let go of the steering wheel. And you'll see that you'll shift off.
You'll
the
see that your alignment is adjusting.
Your alignment's wrong, right? Actually, if that happens very much, you really should get your car aligned because it damages everything on the car over time. Well, at least the tires and the alignment. Very cool.
Okay, I got
so
point
it is
out.
Rocket science, is what you're saying?
Yes. Which actually brings to mind after it brings to mind something else. But Brian, you were going to say?
I was just going to say I have to point out that the target they are aiming for happens to be the largest planet in our solar system. But I take it that.
But not the orbital path they were looking for, because you can't be too far off that orbital path, otherwise you get an orbit that decays quite a bit sooner than you wanted to, or you fling off and you are no longer in orbit.
Yeah, I actually think hitting Jupiter is no problem. That would be
yeah
of objects on the in the system.
Good point.
Probably easy to
but that orbital keyhole is conspicuously small in the grand scheme of things of 1.7 billion miles.
That's
now,
really cool.
That brought to mind something that I've been watching lately that I think people might enjoy, especially after we made some asides like the short distance between two points may not be a straight line, is if you have not yet watched it, I highly recommend from PBS Space Time. It's a series, and it is not for the faint of heart.
Wait,
but
are you saying it's not accessible?
It is accessible, but you have to put the time in. Like, you can't just go to the most recent episode and be fine. They go like, yeah, watch the previous four episodes first. This is the
you mean because it builds off itself?
Yes. Like, it can't cover space-time and, like, why time dilation happens, stuff like that, in one episode. You need to have a precursor to know, like, well, okay, space is actually curved and here's why. Like, gravity doesn't really exist, and here's why. And gravity is an illusion.
So if I want to invest the time, how many episodes of the show are there?
Oh, the thing is, for that one particular sequence that I was talking about, I think there are four episodes. But there are a lot of episodes and one-offs, and the full episodes are half hour to an hour, and the one-offs tend to be much shorter in the order of like 5 to 10 minutes. But the knowledge you get from it is top-notch, given by astrophysicists, and it's just fun just to stretch your brain because the brain is brain's like a muscle. You got to exercise it.
I don't know. Where are you watching these things?
I was watching it off of the
traditional television,
the Roku stick,
okay.
So the PBS
app.
But okay. You can also get it off of PBS PBS.org.
I know that they have a YouTube channel, which has probably snippets to some degree, which looks pretty cool. Hopefully we'll find a story and Chandler will link it up, a place to actually to view them online. I'm assuming that if it's got a Roku app, it probably has an Apple TV app and maybe even iOS and maybe an Android app. Who knows?
Yeah, the PBS apps are pretty ubiquitous.
Yeah. And the, and PBS, how is it making money from that? Same way it normally makes money, requesting donations, I'm assuming.
Requesting donations. They get underwriting. Also make some deals, like for example the deal with HBO they had for Sesame Street, which was you get the new episodes of Sesame Street first and then you give us money and then we play Sesame Street later.
Hey, this is Geekspeed, that's Miles, I'm Lyle, and we're also talking with Brian, and we're going to wrap it up pretty soon so you guys both get one more story. I want to talk about software and repositories at Google. At the same time, I'm not sure if it's just too geeky for us to get into.
Oh, it is too geeky, but we're not going to go into the full depth. But Google is talking about their source control system. Okay. So we've talked about this in the past. We've talked about version control, and we likened it to Microsoft Word tracking changes and stuff like that. So,
well, to start it all off, if you know anything about this field, like you know Git and you know like Maven
Subversion,
and
Maven,
you know
Mercurial.
Yeah, and it build systems like Make or GMake. Yeah, forget all of that. None of that applies.
So most of the world of development has decided it's better to get small, what they call them repositories, but small groups of code representing an app or a library and breaking them into parts like
modularization. Yeah.
And it's really interesting because Google, of course, they must have a really large code base. They went the opposite route. They decided that since none of the open source and off the shelf tools out there for managing the enormous lines of code and files that go into making all the different sites and apps, none of the software could really handle the size that the of their entire system.
Well,
they decided to make their own.
They started with off the shelf.
They started with Perforce,
yeah. Oh.
But around 2000, they broke away and decided to make their own system. And it handles an incredibly complex number of files and information. So
their source code is 86 terabytes?
No,
well, that's all revisions. That's the whole repository.
And it's not just code. There's going to be all kinds of things put into the system.
Yeah, the image assets and stuff like that.
Okay, yeah. I'm just thinking about the amount of typing. Okay, go on. We have more stats?
Well, yeah. So they were likening it in this article to the Linux code base. Now, this is the code base that builds an entire kernel and operating system.
Well, when you say an entire kernel, the kernel is actually relatively small relative to things. Like the X Windows system is probably larger in lines of code than...
But anyway.
Anyways, every day at Google, they're checking in as many lines of code are in the Linux code base.
Yep.
So in 2014, 15 million lines of code were changed. Now, that does mean that 15 million lines was typed. Like, humans typed that much. 15 million
is
a lot.
Or deleted.
Which is actually a better thing in software development.
Yes.
Almost always.
Not as many as are added. That's just
in
the nature of the beast.
And that 15 million is in 250,000 lines of repository weekly. Sorry,
yeah.
250,000 lines.
By over 50,000 software developers.
Is that how many people work there?
Well, no, there's more work there, but I'm talking about just software developers.
So if you know anything about software development...
Across the world.
Oh, it says 25,000 Google software developers in 2014.
Yes.
In the article.
If you know anything about software development, one of the things that is hard to manage is when you want to merge in changes from multiple people back into what's usually the development branch or the main trunk of the of your environment.
So if I'm working on something that's not done, you're working on something that's done, and we both try to check it back in, then we might collide with each other.
Yeah, we may have worked in the same files.
Right.
And the system has to figure out whether it can intelligently combine that or whether it needs to ask the user, hey, what goes in this?
And that's called a merge.
Yeah, that's called a merge.
And Google has a very good solution to that.
Yeah.
You just don't branch.
So it's everybody's working in the same live, what we call branch, the same trunk.
Wait, so what happens if you and I both work on something at the same time? in the same place.
Then the person
do you get
who,
to lock it? Or?
The person who checks in first is the one that you have to refactor your stuff around.
Wait, what if you get a pull request in first? Or like a change? Like, don't you get like kind of a review process?
Yes, you do.
And what happens if... Who?
And the other person goes through a review process, and they're happening in parallel. And whoever gets checked in first, my line is...
Whoever passes the review process first gets in.
Well, pass the review process, and then you do your check-in. And it depends upon which group you're in, but with my group, that was the case. And so then you do the check-in, and then the next person tries to do a check-in, and so it's like, sorry, you're not on the right revision. So you do a sync. And if no lines were in common with yours in the same file, you're golden.
What if things were – you mean it automatically merges or you have to do it?
Right.
Okay.
No,
if there is changes? But also just because there's no changes in the same lines does not mean that
you should always go back and check. Okay. But you don't necessarily have to go back review. It depends upon which group you're in. Some things you can see they're pretty well isolated. But in general, after you've synced again, you'll want to run your test suite again just to make sure, do I get clean tests again, and then check in.
And the upshot of this is easier than the way most of the development world seems to be doing it, where...
Well, the thing is, it catches a lot of stuff, and you think it would cause more of a problem than it does. Now, if you aren't moving very fast, it's really infuriating. because you're constantly bumping into it. But if you're coding faster and keeping up with the herd, as it were,
staying ahead of the team,
then you don't run into the problem as much as you do otherwise. Like, it happens every once in a while, but for the most part, you don't have the same people working on the exact same sections of code.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do have that, in general, you have an understanding of who is working on it, and you start to work with each other. You have a conversation with someone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you get around it. You're not making a technical solution to a social problem.
Right.
Well, this sounds like an amazing system. It runs in 10 different data centers across the globe, and somehow they're able to keep consistency across the...
It was just 10? I thought it was more than that.
And I have to say it relies completely on being connected. You cannot do this work without being connected. In a Git environment, like Netflix uses,
it's pretty popular right now.
Pretty popular.
Git was tried out at Google, and it was... There was so much infrastructure that was already made for it, and was such a change to the development culture.
In a Git environment, I don't have to be online. I can be developing and working and doing all this stuff without any of that. And then the choice of merging back in becomes the complication step.
Yeah.
But in some ways, it gives you an affordance that's different. You can work collaboratively on secondary branches. But it's true that when you finally try to push all that stuff together, that's when you run into a problem.
Yeah.
And the solution that Google has is a lot simpler.
Yeah. Well, they do have branches at Google, and that's after it's been... Auto release it. They branch it.
Right.
And so, if you've made a change that somehow got through testing, but then you saw someone found the bug and it was already in production or was already in staging, that's a different branch. You need to go to that branch and fix it as well, or fix something that's live, which is nerve wracking.
I bet.
I'll get out
because you have a few users at Google, right? Like, it affected things.
But at the same time, they have safeguards against that. You're making a check-in to live code. You need to have a reason for it. You need to have the check-in for the development branch to be as a mark-off point to say, like, this is something that has already gone through review. And then you have the release team that says, okay, that looks kosher. And so, yeah, it's...
So, anyways, that was really fascinating.
And the Sitsi client.
Yes. So, you want to explain that since you bring it up?
No, this is your story, Brian. Explain what a Sitsi client is.
I have not used the Sitsi client. There's multiple ways to access all the files. One of them looks like a file system to the computer, and the other is through a web-based client called the... what's that stand for? It's in this article.
It's called Cider.
Oh, you call it Cider?
Well, that's the name of the web app that I used.
Yeah, CITC stands for...
Sitsi, client in the cloud.
Oh, that's it, client in the cloud.
That's the overall infrastructure that goes through, yeah.
Yeah, but you bring that up because...
Because if you're working through a web interface, which they were pushing very hard when I was still there, I don't know if they still are, probably still are, file systems don't really matter. You're going through a web interface.
When you're saying a web interface, are you talking about your IDE is a web
yeah.
page? They're moving that direction?
Well,
I'm assuming you were using Eclipse when you were doing Java, right?
It was a choice up to the developer. There are many developers that used Eclipse. There are other developers that used Emacs. And there were other developers that used...
Vim.
At times, yeah. And then there was, you know, the web interface, which allowed you to check out files pretty seamlessly and edit stuff. It was not as polished as Eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a give and take. But Citsi, how I thought of it a lot of times, ended up being the when you mapped it to your workstation or mapped it to your laptop, whatever, that no source code is ever checked out to your workstation or to your laptop.
You're actually doing like a VNC, a remote connection to some other space.
It's like an NFS share to it with a lot of extra stuff added to it.
Though you have like a command line interface and do things and browse a file system,
you're acting on it as though it's on your local system,
right.
But it's not.
Right. And when the tools are in place for that, it's really great because, of course, you can just throw your computer away, grab another one, log in, and everything's the same.
Right.
I mean, that's
and if
awesome.
Someone steals your laptop, even though the laptops are encrypted, so if you don't have the password, you can't get it.
Yeah.
If you lose your laptop, it's still assumed that you're not going to be able to get access to the system.
Well, Brian, great story. Thank you so much.
I'm sorry. It just brings back all these memories.
No, it's good. It's good. It's good to have a first-hand knowledge.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so Miles, your last story is a completely obvious one, and that is about VR, virtual reality. By the way, last week I finally played with the Oculus Rift that I've had at the office here for a while. We have a few systems set up. And the Oculus Rift version 2, the version 1 I played with when I was at UCSC, had pretty good screen. It was interesting because it tracked really well. Miles, I showed you that, right? Didn't you see the Oculus Rift 1?
I don't think I did. I think you showed me the hardware, but I never actually used it.
Okay.
Hey, this looks neat. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, blindfold, neat. It tracks your head pretty well. The Oculus Rift 2 tracks your head really well. The resolution's better, but also has built-in headphones, which give you, you know, automatically all the demos have object spatial audio. So if a fish swims by you, you can hear the fish paddling in the water, and then as it swims from one side to the other, you hear it get louder in one ear versus the other.
That's a good
ear.
Way to make people dizzy on purpose.
It actually didn't get me dizzy at all. The other thing,
you
it
know,
has,
I mean, like if the software developer get things wrong,
you could mess someone up big time. The other thing that it did is it has a piece of hardware that's basically a camera that kind of detects where you're looking. So when you put the headset on, it detects your head's being put on, and then once it's on, the camera kind of looks at you and knows, oh, that's neutral position. And so from there there forward, as you move around, you position it right. So the game can start in the right location. With the Oculus, the first version, you'd put it on, and depending on which way you're facing, sometimes to actually do the demo, you'd have to turn around in your chair and be completely facing the opposite direction. And the only interface of the first one was the mouse. So you're like leaning away from the computer and using your mouse behind you. It was really confusing. So they did those kind of bells and whistles of making it a lot easier to use. And I got to say, if I was a gamer, I'd be totally doing this. It's awesome. So that's the quick digital review of the Oculus Rift release version. I'll do the Vive version in a couple weeks because I've got one upstairs for that too. Maybe we should do that after the show today.
So VR has been really taking off in the last, 2 years or so?
Big time.
Yeah, so it's about 2 years. You know, 20 months, you know, give or take, something like that. That's been really hitting it.
And by
something else has taken off coincidentally at the same time that VR has.
What's that?
Porn. I mean, come on. Are we really surprised? Like when the internet first took off, what was one of the first things that sucked up all the bandwidth?
Pornography. Porn. You know, Brian, you asked me earlier how I learned to develop. I learned to develop.
Wait.
No, listen.
Where's this going?
I'd go to porn sites and figure out how they did that amazing thing. Because the webpage stuff that was doing cool stuff was at these porn sites. So I'd be going in there and source code and like, oh, look, they were able to pop an alert box up. That's how they do that, or whatever it was that they were doing at the time. And all the cutting edge stuff is always happening in that space.
Yeah. And when Comdex would hit Las Vegas, across the street, coincidentally, at exactly the same time, were these porn conferences where they'd go across the street and look at all the new network hardware, and because they were pushing the envelope.
So we've all heard how this goes back to the beta VHS wars, where VHS was, I believe, used by the porn industry more. And
it was is that why it won?
They were cheaper players,
and it was inferior too.
Well, there were other things too. VHS allowed for 2 hours. Right off the bat for tapes for movies, whereas Betamax for a long time was only 90 minutes, which limited the movies that they could have on it for a long time. And once you got past that initial thing, people invested in the one, and then it took off.
What kind of rate are we seeing in increase in in the. I mean, how are we doing
there was
this?
there was always some form of VR porn. Like, they always tried it. Like, of all the places you would want virtual reality, like, the porn industry was like, we want that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because VR is going back at least 20 years. This is not right. a new tech.
But that the Google searches for VR porn have increased 10,000% in the last 20 months.
It has arrived.
It has arrived. Well, I mean, that's one of the things you hear about when people have done reviews is that it's an interesting thing. I haven't seen that, but obviously first person is what VR is. So it makes sense if you want to be in a first person porn that you'd use VR.
And if, yeah, anytime a new technology comes out where it's a new perspective or new sensation.
A new perspective.
I can't believe I just said that.
it happened with Google Glass early too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is augmented reality, of course. All right. Well, thanks for that closing story. Hey, this is GeekSpeak, and the GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which means you can reuse our stuff any way you like. Just let them know that we said hello. Give us some credit. Thank you very much to our intern, Chandler, who's in the room with us today. Good to see you, Chandler. And also to our patrons, Pat Hedder, and actually a whole list of people, which I'll do in a soon-to-be episode of thanking all the people that are contributing. Of course, if you would like to contribute, you're welcome to join us at geekspeak.org/support. And thanks so much to Greg Merkley, our Canadian correspondent, who provided this week's working title, Code Talkers Orbit Jupiter in VR. Theme song by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music, and thank you all for being here for episode 27 of our 16th season. Anything you want to definitely cover in the post?
Well, I did want to say one thing that was outside of the show, which was, I am sorry for jumping all over that Google stuff, but you have to also understand that there's a bunch of stuff that I don't feel ethically that I could talk about with regard to the network infrastructure outside of the company. And so as soon as you
I'm still going to put this in the podcast.
No, that's fine. Okay, right. This is the commentary afterward.
Sure.
When you posted that article, I looked at the article to see like
what can I talk about.
What can I talk about? Oh, I can talk about that. I can talk about that. That was really cool.
Are you under an NDA with Google?
I'm talking about just as ethics. There's no good reason for me to talk about a process in there if it isn't applicable outside of Google. And
right. Okay.
I kind of see the utility.
It would be like if you talked about, you know, maybe you noticed some kind of vulnerability to the system or something and you talked about that, that would be unethical. But if you're talking about like the processing stuff, I almost think almost everything that's being done there could be interesting and applicable to other places. I don't understand what could – can you
that's
think
the
of
thing,
a
though,
theoretical it, thing that wouldn't be appropriate to talk about that you might know? And I know it's hard because you actually might have something.
Can I think of a theoretical thing?
Yeah, just let's say you leave GeekSpeak. All of a sudden, you abandon us after 15 years or 16
okay,
years.
Okay, first off, GeekSpeak is not a multi-billion-dollar multinational corporation.
Pretend that it was. Pretend that people's lives hang in the balance of what we do.
Talking about geek personal lives and how it affected the show production over the years.
Okay, yeah. That's just not really applicable about the show itself, but more about the how the sausage is made.
Yeah, and yeah, you could talk about, I mean, and it would be very clear. You could go back to the show and say, I see when this happened, and this is where the show didn't have this person, or this show ended up being more curt, and this one had more news stories and had fewer news
right,
stories.
Right.
But it's like, no.
I can talk about, but
I would feel comfortable talking about how do we get our news.
Right.
And like, okay, that's not really...
Did you have any questions, sensitive. Brian, from that article that Miles would know?
I didn't. I thought, everything in the article is pretty well explained.
Yeah, it does seem to me.
I didn't see any. I mean, this was written by a Google representative.
Yeah, it
representative.
Was written and sanctioned by Google, which is why I was so excited, going like, yes, I don't have to mince
it's
words.
Public.
They're totally cool with it being out there, so I'll talk about it, yeah.
No, but I was just fascinated that it's entirely opposite of what the rest of the industry's, fad or what's popular right now. Doing a single... repository.
What's this open source? Microsoft open sources a checked C, a safer C version. What the heck is that?
Well, the C language, portable assembly language,
yes,
was its idea, because beforehand you had to write to the specific processor that you, and processor revision that you
which
were
would be
working
completely
for.
Untenable at this point with our millions of processors out there.
Yeah. Well, it, we just wouldn't have, yeah, yeah, wouldn't have what we have today. And so it allowed you to write loops and set variables and allocate what, memory without knowing what is, it was going to run on.
What is unsafe about C? What is, what's safer about checked C, a different version?
If you've ever heard in a security thing a buffer overrun or a buffer underrun.
Yeah, we talk about it all the time.
Right.
Sure.
That's because when you allocate, for example, a space for an array in C to say, on hey, I want, I'm going to store someone's name and I'm going to say, you know, 256 characters. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how big I'm going to put the space for the person's name.
I hope you don't have a long one.
Right. And then Bobby Tables comes along and XKCD reference.
It's a great one. Little Bobby Tables.
Drop tables.
Little Bobby Drop Tables.
Yes. someone come, usually someone from southern India, I would actually think, that comes up quite often. Names that just blow it out. Or you have someone who's malicious,
right,
just wants to...
So all of a sudden they try to enter something that's longer.
Yes.
258 characters.
And the way C works is everything is treated as basically a flat memory structure.
Right.
And so if you have an array that's 256 characters long, the 257th
is
character, as it were, is actually the first block of an integer that comes next, or
something else in the memory space,
right? Or
so when
the function return pointer.
So you can easily make a mistake in programming where you define something and then you put something larger in it, you get an overflow,
or you don't check the range,
right?
Yeah.
So what I'm assuming what you're saying is that checked C doesn't allow you to do that kind of thing.
Exactly.
It's like once you've done something, it kind of locks you to that definition.
Yes.
So is this a compiler change or a language change or both?
Well, obviously. A little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. So it is, they make some language changes to it. So it's not just a new C compiler. It's the checked C language. But it looks mostly like C. And that's the appeal to it, is that it's like a language that people are familiar with, but it has a few little tidbits added to it to make it less of a landmine.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like a good improvement.
I don't know. There's so many interesting languages that are being bantered about now. I see
the
advantage, but...
There's a reason why the Linux kernel is written in C. And that is, C is a very close analog to the machine language that gets emitted. There is some variance because you do have, you know, pipelines on processors and stuff like that, but... in general, even when you want to optimize things to the nth degree and put it into assembly language, you start off writing it in C, and then you put it through a decompiler and gives out assembly language, and then you tweak from there, as opposed to writing it from whole cloth. And you just can't get the same thing with Java, for
right.
example, or Haskell.
No.
Well, I mean, you can. It just probably wouldn't be as fast, because you're not worried so much in the kernel space of memory protection. You're worried about, we're going to work on it. We're assuming we have smart people and we're going to try to get it as fast as possible, and we're going to try to make sure we don't have bugs. But even C++ is so complex a language that making it so that you don't have those defaults, or that something that you don't necessarily see at first glance, for example, from operator overloading, or from, you know, mostly operator overloading.
Yeah.
That something will happen. Like, objects will be created and then destroyed in a single call, and you didn't mean to. You just thought you were making a function call.
You know, I was having a conversation earlier today about Swift and when we might switch over to Swift, Swift 3, but Swift in general, rather than Objective-C. We do iOS development. That's what I work on here. And the idea of, like, when would that be good? And I was kind of saying to people that, like, I like that I've been working the last year in Objective-C, because even though at some point the future of iOS development, if I stick with iOS development, will be Swift, I think always having that strength of going back to Objective-C and having that foundation will be really helful. And then the developers who I was with are like, no. In the future, it'll be Swift and still C. It won't be, like, Swift, mm-hmm. Objective-C, and C. And my argument was that, well, there's still a lot of core foundational library in iOS that's Objective-C under the hood, and Swift is really a wrapper for that. But their argument would be, no, but that's true right now. But given enough time, it'll be gone. But C won't be. Like, it'll still be you can mm-hmm. drop into C to do the things you need to do.
That's true. I mean,
because Objective-C always had a limit as well. You would jump out of Objective-C to go to C.
I just think it'll be quite a while. I mean, Brian, I'd like your opinion now that you're doing Swift full time, or Swift partially too. That when you're in Objective-C and you need to drop into C, that happens rarely. When you're doing Swift, sometimes you have to drop into Objective-C. I'm assuming that will probably hold on for a while. Or are you not doing any Objective-C in the stuff that you're doing with Swift?
I haven't had to go to Objective-C in a while.
Interesting.
There was a point working with some of the C APIs that it was Swift was still young enough that there was too many things to figure out how to make it interoperate between the two languages that I just went back to C.
You went to C or Objective-C?
Well, it was Objective-C, but the code I was writing was it was C inside of a
Objective-C function.
C calls within Objective-C are just a weird.
I mean it's
actually,
I mean,
not that,
it's not that weird.
I don't know. When I did it, it was just always just kind of, maybe it was because I was learning Objective-C at the same time. I was like, wait. Because the rules are different. Even though the syntax is the same, the rules are different. The calling conventions are different.
So, Brian, what's your thought? How long till Objective-C is gone from iOS recommendations?
Well, Objective-C is not going to be gone for decades. I'd say 30 years, it's still going to be some code around. But you, as an application developer?
Yeah, starting from fresh, doing iOS development.
It's gone for a lot of people now.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's...
If someone's just starting out, is there any reason for them to learn Objective-C as opposed to just start with Swift and
just go... You mean to learn the language? No, there's no reason to start learning with Objective-C. There is lots of reasons to learn Objective-C eventually and broaden your knowledge and understand why things are the way they are. But as of this year with they call it the great... renaming. There's a lot less vestige of the Objective-C mindset left in the conversion to Swift, because they take the APIs that are written in an Objective-C mindset and then they run it through this name converter that spits out something that looks a lot more like what a Swift developer would choose to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's just going to speed up those
corners. Do you think I've wasted the last year of my life learning Objective-C?
No. You now have a deeper understanding. But
and you're now available to debug all the old code.
No!
I will say the hard part is taking a project that is so deep and then starting to convert it over, because jumping context between the two languages is a killer.
Yeah.
It's so much easier just to be able to focus on one
thing. When I was, for a while, I was doing Objective-C and iOS development native and also still doing JavaScript development, and that is a hard shift to do. And I was doing, I remember doing a check-in in the morning on one and something else in the evening, and I'm, doing my closures, thinking about them differently. And, yeah, anyway, I'm glad to be out of working on both of them, though I do miss JavaScript quite a bit. So that's what the GeekSpeak website's for, my hacking on JavaScript sometimes, now that I've changed code in, months. By the way, we got a poll. So one of our patrons actually sent me an email and said, dude, the website has, spelling errors.
Did you see this
poll? Yes, I did. I was I tried to stay out of it. I was just I don't want to be snarky.
I mean, it was 7 spelling errors in 70 words. It was really bad. And so
that's kind of average.
Shut up. So what I did is I wrote back, and I got to look at who it is. But what I wrote back and said, well, GeekSpeak website's actually an open source project on GitHub. Here you go. They made an account and did a pull request. I mean, made the changes, did a pull, forked GeekSpeak, did a pull request, and I merged it. And
that's awesome.
It's live now, so that was awesome. So,
who is this listener?
Okay, I'll look it up right now. Miles, you want to tell a story?
So there was this time when we were talking about, hey, Lyle, can you spell correctly?
I will say I am a terrible speller, and I you are one of the few people I can actually correct the spelling of. And so it makes me feel better about myself and my skills.
He's so bad, bad spellers go, well, I'm not that bad, so it makes me feel better about my skills.
Aaron, thank you so much. Ferrucci actually committed. And actually, Chandler's done a pull request, and Brian. So one commit from Brian, one commit from Chandler, one commit from Aaron, and 177 commits from Lyle.
Only 177.
Hey, I know how to code.
in fairness, you are a great presenter. You're a handsome man. You're a really good coder. You're solid. You're reliable.
Excellent writer of code.
And and he will write the text. Like, he'll get the content out there. He just won't spell it right. Like, it's just one minor little chink in the armor. That's fine. He's a great, overall, well-rounded human being who just has that one chink in the armor.
Now that I know the colleagues that I work with at Netflix, one of the things I found is that when I went through the interviewing process, they had a large discussion about my bad spelling in my code, my sample project. And they talked about it as a detrimental possibility. And it was like, that's not very good. Yeah, I don't know if you really took it seriously. Like, there's a whole bunch of debate about it. Now, like close friends of mine are like, yeah, we almost didn't hire because you're spelling.
Oh, my God. So is this comments or just API choices?
This is – what do you mean? No. It's like, you know, you're going to name a variable, and there's going to be English in the variable so you can understand
that
it.
Won't cause a problem at all.
Those won't be necessarily the correct spellings of those words. And later people will be like, what?
No, I meant to spell tentacles. Tentacles.
It was really. Did you just go there, dude? Come on.
What's wrong with tentacles?
Anyway, the thing that was actually worse for most of the IDE people had no problem. It was like the VI people that were really like, damn it, because they'd spell something correct and maybe their IDE wouldn't actually catch that the variable hadn't been defined and it wouldn't work. So anyway,
at least you didn't use A, B, X.
You have no idea how commonly I copy something from my editor. I open a new browser. I put in the word, get the spelling correct from Google, and then go back to my code. I really should get a plugin for my IDE.
Well, somebody I follow on Twitter, an iOS developer, he was asking for the same thing.
I need that.
But it doesn't exist. I looked.
I know.
Wait, Xcode doesn't have a spelling checker?
Sure, it has a spelling checker, but if you make a composite word, like a camel case variable name, that's not a word. That's like three words squished together, so it's not going to spell checker for
actually,
you.
Actually, no, it doesn't have a spell checker in it. You can't spell check your code.
Actually, there are IDEs out there that will spell check. They'll say that.
I'm sure.
Do you mean good IDEs? You mean good? Because I use Xcode from Apple, and that's not a good IDE.
Does Xcode at least check your comments?
Get
for
this
spelling?
No, it does not.
There's no spell check. Wow. Joe, get this though, Miles. This is one of the ones I love. You can theme Xcode. Okay, so you can make a dark background, which I actually enjoy, especially in certain environments, having dark background with light text. And the theme I use is great. In the code and like the place where you can like debug and code and like, you know, print console log kind of stuff, that also takes on the theme. But the cursor there, you cannot change the color of the cursor. So the cursor in your dark background is always black, which means you can't see it. So if you do a dark theme, you can't know where your cursor is. It's like, thanks, Apple. I guess they
because
all like
Apple was right the first time. Why were you changing the theme?
No, you know that all the developers there use white because, you know, it's all Apple and beautiful. No offense, all Apple developers out there. Please, if you do work on Xcode, let us know. I'd love it. There's actually a way to hack it. You can replace the cursor's an image. You can actually replace the image.
No, writing that code segment is not the primary use for Xcode, though. Like Xcode, their primary goal is stuff like, here's your UI. Here's your wiring for you do this event and you wire to this
interface
point
builder.
And then you write a little bit of code to make that work or you tie it into the input to another thing. So, and they do that. Xcode does that better than anything else that I have seen. In terms of user interface building and stuff like that?
If you actually develop large projects in Xcode and you use Interface Builder, you go insane. Because every time you open the file, it's like, well, maybe now the file's changed. You look at the XML,
misunderstand.
You're like, it's not really
changed. You do user interface code anywhere, and you tend to go insane. Like,
no,
UI
I have
code,
to say, if you're doing UI development in for web or a web environment, and you can use Chrome, it's lovely. I mean, I love it. You get CSS there.
Is that why there are so many JavaScript libraries for doing UI code?
Oh, no, it's true. But I mean...
Because that's what you're talking about when you go into Chrome.
Let me put it this way. I've been a web developer for 20 years, right? And I have
And you've
said
been a good
so
web
many...
developer for 15.
Thank you. And I've said so many bad things about CSS over the years. I've interviewed CSS experts on the show. We talked about it. You and I have talked about CSS, mm-hmm. how awesome it is and all that, what its deficiencies are, and like really been upset mm-hmm. about some aspects of it and how frustrating it is. I miss CSS almost every day that I work on iOS development without CSS. Because you want to change a font? Yeah, you can open Interface Builder for that. Or you can try to find the magical string in Xcode and put it in there. And you want to change that variable? Oh, you want to get that from a server? Oh, well, good luck with that. I mean, it's just so it's so hard compared to having a CSS file.
What you're saying, though, is okay. Yeah, the Xcode is a multi-headed Hydra beast where you have
basically that's it.
People want to start. Here you go, and yeah. Then once you get past a certain point, you go like, yeah, just forget everything you did before.
Oh no, the demo level stuff. Xcode's awesome, but it's the larger project, multiple users editing that does get.
So have I just added myself to how far I've gone with my
Xcode?
Yeah,
you went through the
expertise.
Demo. And it was awesome. Brian and I are like coding it all the time. I mean, no, do you like interface? Oh, you're not doing a lot of interface builder stuff, right?
Oh, not lately. I haven't been, but. I like it, but you have to get over that mystery part. You have to get over, why does this work? How is this actually working in code? And then there's the whole merge problem.
Yes.
Which, it's an XML file?
Yeah, it is an XML file.
Right. So you open it up, you look at it, you close it, you've changed it. You try. Somebody else does the same thing, and you try to submit your code back to the repository.
So the extension for a interface builder file, for some of them, is XIB, is ZIB. And I got to say that if you see one in the navigation and you click on it, yeah, you're going to have to... You have just committed to making sure you revert that file unless you change it. And then if you change it, you got to hope that no one else has changed it. So before you ever change an interface file, you make sure you get the most recent copy and then maybe check with colleagues. Are you going to work on that page?
Whereas there's a ZIB, but previous to that, there were the NIB files, right? Which were a binary format where you couldn't even do a diff at all anyway. So
XIB
is all there. Yeah, that's true.
And they've changed it a bunch apparently.
Wow, we went down the rabbit hole post-show and talked about coding.
Well... Do you think the general audience would listen to this?
You know, I've been hearing from some of the people that we're communicating with more that since we went off radio, we have gotten more technical and we don't describe, like, I didn't say what VR was while we were going through the story. I didn't talk about what it was. I didn't say what Oculus was. I just kind of said it because I didn't kind of understand that if you're able to subscribe to a podcast, you probably know what VR stands for. Like, this is a boundary. More importantly, if you've stayed with us for any length of time, you probably know what VR is. So I definitely think, I don't think about the just average person going from the grocery store to house and they turn on the radio. That's not my focus anymore. It's just unfortunate, but that's the case.
Yeah, but if anybody's listening to this point now, let us know. Tell us what are you enjoying.
Wait
about
a second.
That?
You've just very much selected your audience to talk
I know,
to.
I know.
I've been talking about coding for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
You're still listening. Oh, so you like coding.
No, but even though we didn't define what VR was, because that is in popular culture now. For the large extent, I would think the first portion of our show, or the actual show itself, was accessible, and that we went down the rabbit hole. But that was when we have an accessible show filter off and started just talking.
Yeah, that's the whole idea of the post show. Yeah, yeah, we can do anything we want. So the other aspect of this though is that I don't think if we when GeekSpeak started, I remember like you'd say something like. Well, you know, USB 2 is coming out. And I'd be like, oh, what's USB, Miles?
Universal Serial Bus. And that takes over from the serial port, which was actually...
And of course, I knew what that was. Like, I didn't need to ask that. Or, like, my role was to be stupid on the show. And over the years, I've just gotten less and less interested in doing that. And so now, we just don't do that very often. You know?
Well, we kind of switched up for a while. There were some times where I would reverse the role and I would ask you, like, what is that thing? What is that
thing? But you're not very good at being stupid.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think that we have changed over the years and gotten more, more
so
technical.
Watch,
but at the same time, I think the general audience has gotten more technical, right? Yeah. Years ago, people didn't know what a social network was, and we had to explain it.
We used to talk about geek houses, and now it's like every house is wired for the internet 24/7, and people use the internet. So they're
all right. Are we done here? By the way, do you have a pull request pending? You have two pull requests pending on GeekSpeak website. Are they actually like?
Is this a database change?
Are they actually like?
Or are these the ones that you never actually?
Wait, let me see this commit. Oh, your branch is out of sync.
Uh oh.
Files change.
Merge conflicts on the show.
Oh my gosh! You actually have a. Oh. Oh, I know. I didn't merge them. Yeah.
Because you hate me.
No, it's because we're using Capistrano, and you changed the Capistrano recipes to install the right version of Postgres. But for me to update to Rails 4, I am actually going to drop Capistrano and go to some other methodology.
Oh, well, thanks for noting that in the comments.
I think I have too much guilt to notice it.
Maybe this is why I've only gotten 3 commits.
It's a moot point anyway, because the new version of Ubuntu supports the newest version of PostgreSQL, and that's out of the box, and there you go.
I'm denying this pull request right here, baby. Close pull request, no.
Oh man!
No, that was the wrong one. You did two of them, the same thing. So maybe I'll merge it. All right, are we done?
Unless you want to talk about Swift on the server, and we're going to do the GeekSpeak site.
Oh, I'm so tempted to do that. Is there something that's viable yet?
I haven't done it myself, but yeah, they're out there.
Is there like a Swift node?
No, it's not node. It's just a sort of Ruby on Rails like competitor.
Do it, Miles. Do it.
Miles, why don't you just build an IDE or a GeekSpeak site editor like from scratch? What would you use at this point? Java? Beans?
Well, in terms of an editor...
You see, Miles and I have a long history. He makes backend infrastructure, and then I make it editable. Like, that's... we've been doing that for 20
years.
You made it
editable?
What? Yeah.
Dude, when I had Cocoon, like, it was totally not editable.
No. No, to be clear, when we first worked together, you hired me at a company, and you had already built this giant infrastructure, and I put a front end to it. I put the CRM in front of Feed the Monster Media, right?
Oh, okay.
Right? So that's what I did. Like, you had this giant, really beautiful system, and then we had, like, 20 employees that were supposed to edit content, and they couldn't.
Yeah, and you were writing in Visual Basic, so I was like, yeah, whatever, you seem to be doing the right thing. I'm going to leave you alone.
Yeah, when you do VBScript in browser, you get no pull request, you get no confirmation of your code. Nobody looks at it. Nobody wants to look at it. That was horrible. But no, at Cocoon, didn't I make an editor to some degree when you did the Cocoon XML files? Or did I finally just scratch that whole thing and that's when I put in Ruby? Yeah, that's what happened. God, we've got
no
topic.
Well, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
No, so we want a REST interface, and I think the idea is that I don't really want to care what thing it is. I want to have the front end not care what the back end is doing, just have an API. Because that's actually something that is a saving grace behind when we're talking about the failings of CSS or HTML or whatever, is that CSS, HTML, JavaScript, they have a spec.
Yeah.
And they have multiple implementations of that spec. And so you know when something is devious from that spec, you go like, hey, that's a bug. You have something that goes wrong in an API for a company, and that company is the only one that makes that API. Oh, that's just how it's done. But I think it would be cleaner this way. No, that's how it's done now, and that's how people do it. So,
yep.
And that's how you get so many ad hoc things, as opposed to...
So, okay, let me ask you. Why,
and that's why it goes much faster than the standard
bodies. Why do individual companies that need, like, an app decide to build their own rather than making an API so other people can build them? So, like, I have
control.
Yeah, but they make crappy apps, and they regularly make bad apps. They give them away for free, but they're not very good. And examples of this
is
like...
because they're crappy apps. If you... it depends upon the company. Like, there are some companies, GitHub, I believe, is one of them, where when they write code, they're writing it for the API, and then they're reading their own API.
Yeah.
And so anyone who's talking to it has the same thing, because their API is their core... release, as it were.
Sure.
They really don't care all that much how you talk to them, because the platform is what they find interesting and want to get value from.
So what you're saying is you're going to make a GeekSpeak website API that I can write to?
I would like to do that, yes.
Okay, that sounds good.
Is basically REST. I mean, that's... and then talk about this is what...
What about authentication? You're going to do authentication too?
Yeah.
All right. Let's see that next week, okay?
But...
sorry, but like, okay, so Nissan has an app for the Nissan Leaf. Why didn't they make an API for it instead of building an app?
Twitter, they have their front end and they work with that, and their third party calling thing was a secondary concern. How do we get people to talk to the Twitter ecosystem? But they were focused on how do we as Twitter get out there to have people do text messages to us? How do we make a web page for us?
Yeah.
And so when they decide, like, you know what, this third-party API thing is just way too much trouble. Like, that was a sign. The third-party API thing was the thing they did after the fact, after they made the functionality for themselves, as opposed to let's update the third-party API as we're going along so then we can use that functionality for the front end.
I thought the reason why they downplayed the API was they couldn't do advertising as well inside it, and therefore they wanted to push people to their site. I thought that's why they were downplaying the API. I mean, the thing is, the API, the Twitter API example is in like every how to program services. Like, that's the example they've got. And the libraries are still available. You can download Twitter's iOS library to do a Twitter app. Like, that seems like still relatively supported. At least it exists.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go to an example of like Nikon making a camera app that just blows to control your Nikon through your phone.
Well, that's not
why don't they make an API? Like, it would be so much better for them. They'd have all these great apps out there.
Probably because the people making the decisions just don't even have a clue about how that works.
Right, they just hire some company.
There's also the person that works there.
Yeah.
The person who's working software development at Nikon may actually be a generally good coder or not. No, I think
it's a separate agency.
But they're not – yeah, but they're not also – they're not invested in that company, and they're like, let's make this item and make it work according to what Nikon asked for. Nikon may not be technical enough to ask for that question. There are also companies that have a far too great a hubris with regard to what their stuff is doing. So like, we can't put an API out there. That's our special proprietary stuff, and we don't want our competitors to know about it. You don't want competitors to know about you make a submit a comment? You don't want – what?
I know. It's ridiculous.
But there's also, if they have their own app, they can control like where the bugs are. Because you put a third-party API, people are going to use it in ways that you didn't envision. And then suddenly you're going like, oh my God, our stuff has a buffer overflow in this place we totally weren't testing at all. And
hide it. Don't tell anybody.
Yes.
Miles, Brian, thank you so much for joining me.
I was like, please let me leave.
This was supposed to be a short show.
It was. an hour and 40 minutes. That's the longest one we've ever done. Congratulations, gentlemen.
It's a good thing we started on time.
Actually, we kind of did.
So 50 minutes off. That's closer than we've ever been.
All right, we're done.
All right.